The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Thank you. Good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon. How are you? If you want to contact the programme, 51551, ray@rte.ie. I was in the Mansion House this morning to launch the Irish Kidney Association Donor Awareness Week, which happens every year. And it's to get people to get donor cards. It's to get people to click or tick when they're applying for their driver's license, so to make sure they have that 115 on their driver's license, which indicates that in the event of a terrible tragedy, that the people around you, your loved ones, will know that you wanted to donate your organs. I met amazing people there, both sides, people who'd received organs, like Adele, who'd received a liver. I met Mick. Mick's from Cork, and he received a heart. Garrett French has received two lungs. Mary Verbruggen from Uachtaráard, she got donation of a kidney from her brother Tom, and she's waiting for a pancreas now, and that'll come from a deceased donor, and she spoke eloquently, as they all did. And then Gráinne Wise told the story of her brother Rory, and Rory died at the age of 37 of an aneurysm on the brain, and his organs were donated, and as a result, five people are living now because Rory's organs were donated to them. And that's the, I suppose, the miracle of organ donation. There's a couple of things. Well, the main thing this year is that they're encouraging people to have a conversation. I was saying this yesterday. We were speaking to David Crosby, who has received two lungs. The main thing is that you have a chat with your loved ones, with your family, your wife, your partner, your mammy, your daddy, your sister, your brother, whatever, and say to them, listen, in the event of a terrible tragedy, I would love my organs to be donated. That's, you need to have that, because it doesn't matter if you have an organ donor card, if you have the 115 on your driving license, or, as I said yesterday, if you have I want to be an organ donor tattooed across your forehead. When it comes to that time, your family will have to decide. They will be the ultimate decision makers. So it's important that you have that chat with them now, I suppose, in the cold light of day before tragedy strikes. And that'd be great. That'd be great if we all had that conversation. The other thing, which I find this hard to believe, Senator Mark Daly sidled up to me and he said, did you know that nearly a million people now have ticked the organ donor part of their driving licence? So nearly a million people in Ireland, which I think is about a quarter of the adult population, have that 115 on their driver licence, which means that they've said they want to donate their organs in the event of a tragedy. However, medical staff cannot access that information. Other people in the state can access that information, but medical staff can't. So in the event of a terrible car accident or an aneurysm or whatever might happen to you or one of your loved ones, they'll be lying there unconscious, maybe on a life support system, and they will have ticked the 115, but the people around them may not know that. They may not know that. So that's a woman told a lovely story today. She had met somebody at one of these functions, and her son had tragically died in a car accident, and they had decided as a family to donate his organs, but they had never had that chat. And his mother then was feeling a little bit guilty, wondering if she had made the right choice and wondering if her son would have agreed with donating his organs. And she was racked with guilt over that. And then she was cleaning out his room a number of months after he died, and in cleaning out one of his drawers, she found his organ donor card, which set her mind at ease and at rest. So anyway, have the chat, and it's important that you do that, really important that you do that. Now, on the programme today, sleep is a hugely important thing to all of us. We all try to do it and do it to various degrees of success. Guy Lischner has written a book, which is a brilliant book, on sleep, called The Nocturnal Brain, and we'll be talking to him on the show in about 10 minutes' time. If you have any questions for Guy, he's an expert in the field. Get them into us, 51551, ray@rte.ie. And you may know that currently on Netflix, there is an eight-part documentary called The Disappearance of Maddie McCann and Madeleine McCann. And featured in that are two journalists, Anthony Summers and Robin Swan. They're partners in life, and they wrote a book on the whole Madeleine McCann thing. They live down in Waterford and they're going into our Cork studio to chat to us about their research over the years on the disappearance of Madeleine McCann and why they took part in the documentary and what effect they think the documentary might have on the case. So we'll be talking to them after 4 o'clock, and I know a lot of people, and is it a morbid fascination? But a lot of people are fascinated with that story, and it just touched so many people's lives nearly 12 years ago now. And I suppose it's, you know, there but for the grace of God go away. People have holidayed in Portugal and Spain and all over the place, and just the fact that it happened, she was only 3 going on 4. So I know people have an interest in that. So that's coming up after 4 o'clock. Just a couple of things that you may not have spotted on the papers today. TripAdvisor has named their top 10 destinations to visit in Ireland this year. Top 10 destinations. Sneem in Kerry is at number 10. Then you have Donegal Town, Westport, Cong in County Mayo, Kilkenny, Cork, Dingle in County Kerry, Galway, Killarney. And number one is Dublin, which is no real surprise. But if you look down the top 10 there, there's Sneem, Dingle and Killarney all in the County of Kerry. So they win 3 out of 10. And then you have Cong and Westport in County Mayo. And then all the others are just single counties. In the worldwide list, London claimed the top spot after placing in second in 2018, while Paris and Rome rounded out the top three on the list. And the list is compiled using reviews and ratings for hotels, restaurants and attractions in a given area over a 12-month period. That's the TripAdvisor there. So Sneem, Sneem is tiny. Lovely, lovely. I remember meeting a man there. I went into a small little pub there, and somebody will tell me the name of it, and I was having a mid-afternoon coffee, and he sidled up to me, a lot of sidling up today, sidled up to me and told me that he was the man who was pictured on the cover of, was it Life magazine or Time magazine? And he even had a postcard of himself. I think he was a postman, which he handed out to people. And then I think I bought him a whiskey. And That was my memory of Sneem. Not a big place. Cong, not a big place either. Of course, you have the whole Quiet Man connection there with Cong. And then Dingle. Well, what can you say about Dingle? It's just something special. And it's so far away, you have to make the effort, but it's well worth the effort. This is an interesting one. Have you heard of this? It's an app and a website called... I better get that better right now. I've downloaded it on my phone here. What Three Words... What Three Words is the name of it? And a mom and her daughter were saved by police using What Three Words. And this app can pinpoint any location on Earth using just three words. So Valerie Hawkett, 33, she had a bit of an accident. She went out of control while driving around a sharp bend and her car went flying over a hedge and landed on its side in the field. And she couldn't explain to the police where she was and she needed attention in a hurry. So the centre... a link to What Three Words via text. And she was able to tell them the three words that came up. And they found her. So 60% of the police forces in the world use this system, this app, this website. I don't know if Angarda Síochána use it. It opens on all devices and it's able to find the exact position of any location on Earth using just three words. So it has divided the planet into 57 trillion 3 metre by 3 metre squares. And it assigns each square a random three-word address. So I'm on it now here. I'm just looking to say, I'm in the Botanic Gardens, National Botanic Gardens. So it's given me Ship Sushi Kicks. Ship Sushi Kicks. And if you move it around the Botanic Gardens there, Guides Pizza Closet. So that's more exact than an air code because it's a 3 metre square. Where else is there now? I'm just going to somewhere else that's sort of... Cool Mine Rugby Club. That'll give you a vibe stage putty. So the idea is, if you have this app on your phone, or if the police force text it to you, well, then you just read out the three words and they know exactly where you are because they put it in. They obviously have the website, the app on their system. They put it in and they find you. Amazing. 57 trillion 3 metre by 3 metre squares. I love that sort of stuff. And Valerie, she's from Trowbridge. She says, I was so disorientated after the crash that I didn't know where I was. I could have been in that field all day if it hadn't been for three-word location. What three words? And three is is the number three as opposed to the word three. Yesterday we spoke about seagulls. We spoke about sleeping on whatever side of the bed. Elaine was on to us about the seagulls. Mick Clifford wrote a big piece about Howth, Skerries and Balbriggan, where they have, it seems, a problem with seagulls. Elaine says, I've two seagulls on my roof at the moment and the noise is just dreadful. Clothes on the line are regularly destroyed, as are windows and walls. It's impossible to have a barbecue in the summer without being surrounded by gulls waiting to swoop. Anybody who thinks they are not disruptive doesn't have dozens of them nesting in the vicinity. They are an absolute pest and they invade a housing estate, as is the case here in Balbriggan. That's Elaine. And thanks for highlighting the issue with gulls. Never did I think I would see the day when I would be scared of these creatures. I will not allow my dog out in the back garden when they're swarming around. I hear them squealing from 3 o'clock in the morning this time of year. I live in Marino in Dublin, and if these few past years become a scourge. I have bird feeders for wild birds in my garden, and the gulls are attacking these birds and their young. Their fecal matter is burning the paint from our cars and our windowsills. We need to start culling them now before our water supplies get contaminated by them, says Margot. Culling's a very serious word, isn't it? And that was mentioned in that article yesterday as well. It's ongoing and we'll keep in touch with that story. Sleep. We had Stephen O'Rourke on yesterday and Stephen got Twitter a-going over the weekend when he said that himself and Amy don't have a particular side of the bed. So it depends on who hits the bedroom first and they choose a side and it's working out fine for them. And then they move the pillows around and then move the belongings around from one bedside locker to another. And also while talking to Stephen then, he told me how he made a cup of tea. Now listen to this. He puts the tea bag in, then the milk and then the boiling water. Now I'm not a tea drinker, but I know that is sacrilege. You don't be doing that. You don't want to be doing that. Surely the idea is that the boiling water brews the tea. And if you put the milk in first, that interferes with the whole scientific process. Anyway, Phil was on. He says, whatever that man does in the privacy of his bedroom is his business, but he's crossed the bloody line with the tea thing. He's messing with a national institution there, says Phil. And the man usually sleeps on the side next to the door. It's a primitive instinctive thing, suggests Jerry in Dundalk. And I was widowed 5 years ago and I still sleep on my own side. See, it's so ingrained. That's that. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Dunmore East has got to be the best place in Ireland. Better weather, better beaches, better food. Top class, says that person. And Aaron here, the pub in Sneem could be called the Blue Bull. Ah, I remember Blue. All right. And saw you on the News of One at the organ donation launch. Also, the little girl in the piece with you, a doughty little one. Good luck to all, says Mary. Well, that could have been Sive. I don't know if it was Sive. It could have been Sive. And then I met Connor and Sarah and their little girl, Annabelle. And Connor donated his kidney to his wife, Sarah. And then she was well enough to have children and they had Annabelle. So that's such lovely stories. Tell your family if you have one, they need to know in case you haven't it always with you, says Reg. Yeah, tell them if you have a donor card or if you've ticked the box on the driving licence. Is the seagull who took my chicken wrap yesterday a cannibal? I don't know is the answer to that. And just on the donor thing, in France it has been decided that you are automatically considered a donor unless you register that you don't want to opt out. Yeah, it's a sort of we have an opt-in process, they have an opt-out process. It is recommended to let family and friends know so they're prepared. Certain religions don't allow you cut up the body after death. Efforts are made to check it if the person is opposed. There you are, take care, Niamh. Yeah, and I was speaking to the boss man for the Irish Kidneys Association, Mark, and it's not as straightforward as you would think. A system like that, and maybe we might get him in or somebody and talk us through that before the end of the week, because it's Organ Donor Awareness Week. I bought 16 gorgeous stamps, €1 per stamp from a post. Be an organ donor, save lives. €1 stamps, have a look at them online. They're just super. Yes, I met Aileen from a post today and she was, and I held one of those stamps. Well, it was a super size one. You'd want to have a very large package now and a lot of glue to stick the stamp that I was holding onto it. Boiling water turns tea acidic. Milk first if using water straight from boiling kettle. Fact. There you go. You see, you think you know it all and you don't. Well, about tea anyway. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. A catchy little tune, as my late dad would have said. Catchy little tune. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Dennis Hyland has been on from Cork and he texted us back on the 22nd of February saying he was awaiting a kidney transplant. Well, he got the call on the 15th of this month and he's doing well. Great to hear from you, Dennis. Glad to hear it. And just listen to people today, the waiting, particularly people who are very sick, the waiting for an organ, because it's completely out of your control, unless you have a live donor. And I've read loads of stories last night and this morning about people, just the waiting process. Imagine that. It's a bit like Groundhog Day. You get up every morning and you hope you're going to get that call. Sometimes you get the call and it doesn't work out and you're back to square one and you start again. And it's I can't imagine what that's like. On seagulls. Two seagulls actually attacked me outside Marks and Spencer's on Liffey Street in Dublin. I'd walked outside the door, having grabbed a quick sandwich on my way to an appointment in the rotunda. I was 9 months pregnant. I thought someone was mugging me and putting a bag over my head as the two seagulls swooped down and one hit me in the head and the other grabbed the sandwich from my mouth. It was so scary and I was crying and everyone was laughing at me. I mailed the council and they said nothing. There was nothing they could do. That's caught in Dublin. I wonder, can you see the funny side of it now, caught? It sounds horrific though. Sounds horrific. And it looked like they were, you know, working in tandem. One of them was providing a decoy while the other swooped in to get the sandwich. What flavour was it? Just looking out my back garden, 10 to 12 seagulls having a barney over dog feed in a neighbour's garden. Some noise, says Patrick. And we cannot live with gulls, crows and magpies, foxes, and yet people in other parts of the world live with tigers, lions, wolves and bears and love and admire them. A bit of perspective is needed here. It's an interesting way of looking at the world. I suppose what has happened is we have changed the environment so much as human beings that it's not really a natural habitat for these creatures anymore. And maybe there are more than there should be. I don't know, but that's a theory. When my father was in the cardiac unit in the Mater Hospital, seagulls were regular visitors. They would stare menacingly in the window at mealtimes. And one day, one brave gull flew in the window of the ward and lifted a slice of meat from a patient's plate. The gall of that gull, huh? I run a small business, artisan chocolate here in lovely Kinsale in West Cork. We have a flat roof right beside the harbour. On a very regular basis, we are bombarded by seagulls dropping mussels from a height onto the roof. Thump, thump, thump. This is fine until a mussel lands on the Perspex skylight. It can be quite alarming, to say the least. Every few months, I climb onto the roof to clear empty mussel shells. It usually amounts to quite a pile. That's Frank. Coco. K-O-K-O. Kinsale. And, oh, for God's sake, tell people to grow up and leave gulls alone. Hey, people, leave those gulls alone. Stop interfering with nature. If we didn't overfish, the gulls would have food in their natural habitat. If we humans didn't dump food in and outside bins, gulls would have no fast food to eat, no reason to come into towns and gardens. We cannot have everything our own way. The call is always cull. It's another word for kill when animals or birds annoy us. Stop being so precious about cars and paint. We can't have the country all our own way. We have to share it with nature. We can't have it all our way, says that person, just to repeat it for emphasis. And on tea, I started to put milk in with the tea bag, as sometimes tea bags cause a scum and it looks horrible. So I wrote to tea bag company why their tea bags were causing the scum. A well-known brand, they never replied, says Breed. Maybe it's in the post, Breed. And tell your man from yesterday, he's drinking hot watery milk. It's a crime to do that to tea. He needs to go down to Barry's and be shown how to make a proper cuppa. That sounds like an opportunity for an outside broadcast down to Barry's to make a proper cup of tea. Put in the tea first, then the milk, then the boiling water. This goes back to the time when loose tea was used. Following this formula keeps the tea leaves at the bottom of the cup. If you want to read the tea leaves, put milk in last. If you want to read the tea leaves, that's Michael McCarty. Thanks, Michael. And Pat's been on, and we'll finish up at this moment. Pat has been on about his peculiarities. Because obviously we were talking to Stephen about his peculiarities with Amy and the fact that he puts the milk in with the tea bag first. Pat says, I always wash my teeth using hot tap. Ah, go on, Pat, you don't have to be doing that. Huh? I always shave with 72 strokes of the razor. I suppose we all have our ways of doing things. But using hot water to brush your teeth, yuck. Yeah, there's more on gulls, and we'll get to those. 51551, ray at rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, yesterday we read out an email from Derek in Paralympics Ireland about a missing Honda Jazz car. And that particular car is owned by Alva Kelly, and Alva is on the line. How are you doing, Alva?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, good to talk to you. Good to talk to you. Let's find out a little bit about you first before we talk about your car. What age are you?
I'm 20.
Right, and what do you do apart from swim?
I'm in college at the moment. I'm in second year studying European studies at Trinity.
Right. And what's your event in swimming?
I'd say my best event would be the 100 metres backstroke or the 400 metres freestyle, between the two of those.
Right. And you've represented Ireland?
Yeah. Proud of that. I've been to European Championships, World Championships, and went to Rio in the Paralympic Games. Yeah. Representing Ireland.
And what's your disability, Alva?
It's a condition called arthrogryposis, which I was born with. It just affects my legs. So I use a wheelchair most of the time, but I can walk short distances using leg splints.
Okay.
Basically.
Right. So your car then? Right.
Yeah.
And this is hugely important to you. Try and explain to people how important your car is to you.
It's massively important, just in terms of independence, I suppose. It's an adaptive car for me, so I can't drive any other person's car in my family. I can only drive that car. And just in terms of getting to and from the pool every day, getting to and from college, like, that's my mode of transport day in, day out. So yeah. A bit lost without it.
What are the adaptations in the car?
So I don't use any of the foot pedals for brakes or accelerating. I just have hand controls,
right.
And I'd have a little adaption on the steering wheel as well, so that I can steer with one hand and use the other hand for the braking and accelerating.
Aha, right. And then I thought, wasn't that great? Because it's no use to anybody else. But the regular pedals are still there. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your wheelchair was in the car at the time?
Yeah, it was in the back of the car, and so was just a bag with some swimming equipment, but I suppose the most important thing is the wheelchair.
Okay, so tell us, it's a Honda Jazz, what colour?
It's a black Honda Jazz, and it has end plates on the front and back. That's probably what would distinguish it from other black Honda Jazz cars.
And 141D35917. So would people looking into the car and know that it had all those adaptations? Is it obvious when you look in?
You should be able to see. If you looked in the front window on the driver's side, you'd see a kind of lever next to the steering wheel, and there would be a little kind of handle on the steering wheel as well. That would be quite visible.
Yes.
And maybe if you looked in the back, you might see a wheelchair.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be able to see that, would they, or would they? Would they be able to see the wheelchair?
Because I shared that the car had been stolen on my Facebook and on my Twitter page, and someone did reach out to me through Facebook because they had seen the car outside their house on Friday morning, and they took a photo and everything because it was blocking their driveway, and they said that they had looked in and they could see my chair in it anyway.
Okay.
And they had taken a photo so I could see it was my car as well.
And then it moved from there, obviously, did it?
It moved from there, yeah. It was there, I think, at 8 o'clock, and when they returned home at 9, it was gone.
Okay, so
unfortunately, we missed it.
Yeah, it disappeared last Wednesday night, between 9:30 and 9:30 from your place out in Castleknock in Dublin 15. Then it was spotted in Blanchardstown. What day was that?
That was Friday morning.
Friday morning.
The 22nd, I think.
Yeah, you've obviously reported to the Gardaí. What did they say about the likelihood of recovering it?
Well, I suppose the longer it's missing, the less likely it is. They definitely said, like, there's a good chance that it'll turn up. It's probably been left somewhere, and it has to be parked somewhere at certain points during the day.
Yeah.
So if someone sees it and it looks suspicious, they might get in touch with the guards. And they said that's what usually happens when a vehicle is stolen. It's recovered because it's been left somewhere, and after a while, someone kind of realizes it's unusual.
Is it interfering with your training then?
Yeah, well, for the time being now, I have to get lifts off. My parents get lifts off different people, which is obviously not convenient for my family, and it makes it a bit more difficult to get there when I need to get there. But I'm lucky that my family are being so helpful, and they're putting off things that they have to do to help me get to where I need to be.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful for that.
And what are you training for at the moment?
At the moment, well, I actually have a competition this week. The national championships are on in the National Aquatic Centre for Swim Ireland, so I'll be racing at that this week, and I'll get a hand from teammates and hopefully family as well for lifts. But the ultimate goal this year is there's World Championships will be on in the summer, hopefully. That's yet to be confirmed, but that's what the goal is at the moment.
So we'll say it again then. It's a black Honda Jazz car. It has N plates on back and front. The registration number is 141D35917. It was last seen in a housing estate in Blanchardstown last Friday morning. And if you see it, you can contact Gardaí or you can contact us. And we'd love to reunite Alva with her car because she needs it. She needs it and she wants it back.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Hopefully, you know, it's bad form to rob anybody's car, but particularly somebody like you who needs it so much. Hopefully, we will get some leads on that. And good luck in the competition at the weekend.
Thanks a million. Thank you so much.
Okay, Alva. Bye now. Bye.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or ray at rte.ie. Did you know that you can survive longer without food than without sleep? And finally, it seems that people, when I say people, scientists and medical people are taking sleep seriously. And if you want to gen up on sleep, can I recommend a brilliant book to you? It's The Nocturnal Brain, Nightmares, Neuroscience and the Secret World of Sleep. And it's by our next guest, Guy Lishner. Good afternoon, Guy.
Afternoon, Ray.
Good to talk to you. So you're a neuroscientist and you specialise in sleep.
Yeah, I'm actually a neurologist neuroscientist.
Sorry, so
I see
there's
patients.
There's a difference. Yes. Sorry about that. You're a neurologist. And why sleep? Why did you decide on sleep?
Well, I think that sleep, as we now know, influences really every aspect of our lives. It influences our physical health, our brain health, but also our psychological health. That was rather unappreciated until recent years. But from a neurologist's perspective, we know that sleep is really important to a whole range of neurological conditions like epilepsy, like headache, and like cognition. So things like dementia or other problems with memory.
So we sort of up until recently just tolerated sleep. It was a time when we couldn't do the stuff we wanted to do.
It was very much seen as a distraction from getting on with your daily life. It was an inconvenience rather than a fundamental part of our lives. I think we've moved very much away from that now, in that we recognise that sleep is actually fundamental to every aspect of our lives. And thankfully, people are now starting to appreciate the importance of sleep and are prioritising sleep to some extent.
Yeah. And sleep is different for individuals. And for individuals, it changes as we go through life.
Absolutely. So we know that in childhood, obviously, we need much more sleep. And as we get older, the amount of sleep that we get lessens. But it's not just the amount of sleep. It's also the nature of sleep and the quality of sleep that changes. So, for example, when babies are born in a premature state, they'll often spend about a third of their lives in rapid eye movement, or what we sometimes euphemistically term dreaming sleep. Whereas actually, as we get older, that amount of dreaming that we do, or REM sleep, changes dramatically. So actually probably only constitutes about 15 to 10% in very late adulthood.
Isn't it amazing that something that we do for a third of our lives has gotten so little attention from the scientific community over the years?
I think that's absolutely right. One of the problems is that we've only had the tools to properly study sleep in the last few years.
And what are those tools, Guy?
Well, we've known that the EEG, which is the test that we do, for example, for things like epilepsy, where we put electrodes on people's scalps and record their brain waves, give us some information about what the brain is doing. But in recent years, we've had a whole host of other techniques, things like genetics, like a type of scanning called functional imaging, which enables us to actually see the function of the brain rather than the structure of the brain, have really pushed our knowledge of sleep forward dramatically. And there are also some very large-scale studies now in terms of looking at populations and how much sleep they get and the nature of the sleep they get and the associations with other health issues. So technology has really driven this forward, and as technology has driven this forward, interest has also been increased. Yeah. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle.
I suppose when you're in a pub or out, wherever you might go, and you're talking to people who've never met you before and you tell them what you do, they all want to know, well, how much should I be sleeping? And what answer do you give them?
It's actually quite a difficult answer to give. I mean, if you look at populations as a whole, we know that things like increased risk of heart attacks, of strokes, of general ill health, even mortality, increase at the margins of the sleep duration. So if you're sleeping less than 6 hours, your risk of mortality and risk of a whole other host of conditions increases. And if you're sleeping too long, that's also the case. Although one of the theories behind an increased risk with increased amounts of sleep is probably because you're sleeping a prolonged period of time because you've got other health issues. But I think that it's important to remember that this 7 to 8 hours of sleep, which is usually what's quoted, it is the case for the general population, but it's not necessarily specific to you.
Okay.
We know that the amount of sleep you need is related to what genes you carry, but also the quality of the sleep that you're getting. So, for example, I have some families, all of whom need 4 or 5 hours a night's sleep and don't seem to have any ill consequences during the day, and other families who need 9 or 10 hours. Okay. I guess the optimal amount of sleep is the amount of sleep that you're getting in order to wake up feeling refreshed, not to feel tired during the day, and then be ready for sleep at the same time the following night.
The function, and I know it's multifaceted, but
yeah.
The main functions of sleep, what are they?
So we think that deep sleep, or what we term stage 3 non-REM sleep, is largely about restoration of function. It's about healing. It's about rejuvenation. If we look at the brain in particular, there are channels within the brain called the glymphatic system, which is a series of channels, a network, that allows fluid to pass through them. And when we look at the brains of animals during deep sleep, during stage 3 sleep, we see that those channels open up by up to about 60%. And so what we think is happening in that stage of sleep is actually the brain is being cleansed of toxins, of the byproducts of being active and being awake for prolonged periods of time. So there is an element of physical housekeeping. Yeah. But we also know that what tends to happen in all stages of sleep to some extent is that the connections between various cells and various parts of the brain are constantly being tweaked. So that's important for memory. It's important for linking up different parts of the brain, and is part of the electrical housekeeping of the brain as well.
Okay. Now, that flushing out of the brain, that's relatively new information, and it's very exciting information, because I suppose then we know that if that happens during sleep, we can ask the question, what happens if it's not been flushed out effectively, if we don't get enough sleep? And what's the answer to that question?
Well, I think the short answer is we're not quite sure.
Okay.
But what is being proposed is that poor quality sleep or continuous sleep deprivation, chronic sleep deprivation, may be an important risk factor for certain conditions like Alzheimer's disease. We know now that even after a single night's sleep deprivation, there are significant changes to certain proteins in the brain that have been implicated in the generation or the underlying pathology of Alzheimer's disease. And so there is a growing literature now regarding the association between sleep deprivation, chronic sleep deprivation, and risk for Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Now, it's an amazing book because it has all that scientific information and what's happening and what might happen in the future, but it also has stories, case studies from your work as a neurologist, as opposed to when you're a scientist. So can we go through a few of those then? Let's take John then. John, who was being aggressive to his wife while he was asleep, completely out of character to John during the day.
So John's wife began to report that he was shouting out and lashing out, punching and kicking in the night, which, as you say, is completely out of keeping for him. During the day, he's extremely mild-mannered, a very gentle soul. And when we brought him into the sleep lab, what we could see is that he was doing that in the sleep lab setting, but was doing this during dreaming sleep. So normally when we're in rapid eye movement sleep, which is the stage of sleep that we most associate with dreams of a narrative structure, and what I mean by that is a story evolving, a film-like plot, we're generally completely paralysed. The only muscles that continue to work are the muscles that allow us to breathe and the muscles that move our eyes from left to right, which is why it's called rapid eye movement sleep. But in some individuals, that mechanism of paralysis, that switching on of that paralysis that is part and parcel of rapid eye movement sleep, doesn't work. And in those individuals, what people do is they act out their dreams, particularly those dreams of a violent or an aggressive nature. And that's what John was doing. So, for example, he would dream of being chased by a tiger, of just about to be bitten, and then he would lash out or kick out at that tiger, but unfortunately would do that to his wife, resulting in her injury.
And how was that solved then?
So that was, in his case, it was treated by generally improving his sleep, but also some medication. We know that there are a number of different options in terms of medication to try and improve that. They usually don't make it disappear completely, but they cause a significant improvement in this aspect of sleep. And actually, he was subsequently, having spent quite some time sleeping in a different bed from his wife, to get back into bed with her.
Now, I've spoken to a man who has Lewy body dementia, and he told me vividly, a vivid description of his night terrors, which sounded similar to John's. Is there a link between the two?
Yes, I think that those night terrors that your person was describing is actually probably the same condition as what John was experiencing, which is something called REM sleep behavior disorder. Yeah. And we used to think that this was a condition that was idiopathic, which really means that we don't understand what's causing it. But it certainly had been very frequently reported in people with Parkinson's disease and dementia with Lewy bodies. What we now understand is that sometimes this condition can be a predictor of developing these conditions, sometimes coming on as early as 10 or 20 years before the onset of these conditions. And in fact, it's probably a very early warning sign that whatever the process that's going on that is generating Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia is actually starting in a different part of the brain, an area of the brain called the brainstem, which is really responsible for generating that paralysis in REM sleep.
Okay, that was Kevin Quaid who spoke to us about Lewy body dementia. Parasomnia, is that an umbrella term for walking in your sleep, talking in your sleep, doing that sort of thing? Is it?
Yes, it's any unwanted behaviour in sleep. Really.
Okay, yeah, a parasomnia. So Jackie, she was able to drive and go on her motorbike while asleep.
Yeah, I mean, hers is quite a remarkable case. This is a woman in her 70s who actually started doing this in her youth. She would occasionally find herself getting up in the morning to go down to breakfast with her landlady, and her landlady would say, "Well, where have you been in the middle of the night? You stomped down the stairs with your helmet in your hand," and she had no recollection of this whatsoever. And then in later life had been witnessed by her neighbours driving up and down the promenade in the seaside town that she lived. So Jackie's experience is really at the very extremes of a condition called non-REM parasomnias, of which sleepwalking is really the typical manifestation. We know that sleepwalking, although it's very, very common in children, continues into adulthood in about 1% to 2% of individuals. And what we now understand happens during sleepwalking and related conditions is that whereas we used to think that sleep was an on or off state, so either the whole of the brain was asleep or the whole of the brain was awake, that actually different parts of the brain can exist in different states. And right. when people with sleepwalking or related conditions have been put in a scanner or had electrodes implanted in their brains, what we can see is that certain parts of the brain remain asleep, and those parts of the brain are typically an area of the brain called the frontal lobes, which are responsible for rational thinking or personality, and an area called the hippocampus, which is responsible for memory, are in very deep sleep. Whereas the areas of the brain that are responsible for movement, sometimes emotion, sometimes vision, are actually awake. So it's the fact that the brain is not in the same sleep state that results in these sorts of disorders.
Yeah. And Tom and Sarah, not their real names. So Tom suffers from sexsomnia, which is very, very rare.
Well, it's certainly something that we see relatively rarely. I suspect that it's probably rather more common in the population if you ask, because at various points sexsomnia has come up in the media, and after each time that's happened, I've certainly had lots of emails from various people saying, oh, I suffer from this as well. So this is really part of the umbrella of parasomnias. It's sexual behaviour in very deep sleep, and that's what Tom is experiencing.
Mm. And that's a fascinating story. We won't go into any more detail there. We have questions from our audience, and we're talking to Guy Leshner, and his book is The Nocturnal Brain. It's a fascinating read, and Guy's going to stay with us and answer your questions after a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
The Nocturnal Brain by Guy Leshner is a book. It's in bookshops now. I saw it in my local bookshop there the other day. Guy, insomnia, I didn't know there were two types of insomnia.
Well, there's probably more than two types of insomnia, actually. It's as with parasomnias, it's a bit of an umbrella term. It describes anybody who has poor quality sleep or limited sleep that's not due to the fact that they don't get into bed early enough or get out of bed too early, but have difficulty getting off to sleep or staying asleep. And people experience different things. So there are some people, for example, who will occasionally briefly wake up in the middle of the night, and their brain fills in the periods of time between which they're awake, and they convince themselves that they're awake during those periods, whereas actually when we record their brain waves, we can see that they're in very deep sleep. And then there are the people...
But before you move on from them, about that, I was confused about that, sleep state misperception. So they're getting a good bit of sleep, but still they must feel the effects of not getting sleep to present to you.
Yeah, well, they do. They complain of the fact that they feel really dreadful during the day, because I think it's important to stress that sleep is a subjective experience, right. And people can experience an unrefreshing sleep even in the context of having a sleep study that confirms that they are having really good quality sleep. Now, what we think is going on, at least in some individuals, is that actually there are subtle changes in the way that the brain sleeps, and perhaps it's important to stress that the EEG, which is the tool that we use to monitor brain waves, really only tells us about the surface of the brain, and we've still got quite a lot more to learn about what's going on in the whole brain, and it may be something about the way that their brain processes sleep that gives them that subjective experience.
Okay, so then there are people who genuinely only get 2 or 3 hours sleep.
Yeah, the commonest form of that is people who have great difficulty switching their mind off. They get into bed, they feel sleepy, but once they get into bed, they feel very awake, and it's almost as if they've lost the switch in order to be able to get off to sleep. And that can be really debilitating, because it sets people into a vicious cycle whereby they have difficulty getting off to sleep. They start getting a bit anxious at the prospect of getting into bed because they dread the night ahead. And then they find that anxiety surrounding sleep actually makes the whole process of getting off to sleep more difficult, and so they end up in a very awful place. As I write in my book, there's nothing quite so lonely as the insomniac, because you're lying in bed in the middle of the night, wide awake, thinking that everybody else is asleep.
And you also say in the book that CBTI, as in Cognitive Behavioural Therapy for Insomnia, is the way forward now for a lot of people.
Well, certainly it's the first step. It's almost the default first option in terms of getting people on an even keel with regard to their sleep. As you know, we used to use drugs very commonly, but in recent years we've very much moved away from rushing for the sleeping tablets, because we know that they're associated with particular problems like dependency, something called habituation, where people require ever increasing doses to to obtain the same effect. And also in the long term, there are some bits of evidence that suggest that actually these drugs have long-term consequences in terms of cognition, in terms of memory. So we very much move towards a non-drug-based treatment, this condition called cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, which really aims to address that vicious cycle that I was talking about, which is that anxiety about sleep, that poor association between being in bed and dropping off to sleep, which is replaced with an association between being in bed and struggling to get off to sleep, actively trying to sleep, really trying to retrain the brain back into a good sleep pattern.
Recondition it, yeah. Okay, so our listeners' questions. I've been told that several times a night I sound as if I'm smothering and then I gasp and resume sleeping. It may happen again or not, but usually once or twice a night. Help.
So that's a very common story that we see in the sleep clinic. The commonest cause for that is a condition called sleep apnea. So this is when the airway, as we drift deeper and deeper into sleep, becomes a little bit more floppy. And in some individuals, the airway is a bit narrower than normal or a bit floppier than normal. That can be related to the shape of our airway, but it can also be related to having large tonsils or some other abnormality within the airway. But the commonest association is with carrying excess weight, particularly on the throat. As the airway becomes more floppy, in some individuals, the airway actually ends up being completely obstructed. And so that causes you to be breathing against a closed airway. That causes your heart rate to go up, your oxygen levels to drop down. You partially wake, and then as you partially wake, the airway opens up again. And in some individuals, that results in them fully waking up with a sensation of choking or gasping. There are some other possible explanations for that, but that's by far the most likely explanation.
And you talk a lot about sleep apnea in the book, and it's not just a disruption of sleep, it has knock-on physical effects on you.
Yeah, we now understand that sleep apnea is associated with a whole range of other conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, stroke, heart disease, a whole range of conditions. And what we now are also looking at is whether or not there's an association between obstructive sleep apnea and Alzheimer's disease. Because in addition to what we talked about in terms of the lymphatic system and the removal of toxins from the brain, what also tends to happen is if your brain is continuously being starved of oxygen repeatedly throughout the night, and sometimes this can occur up to 100 times an hour, so it's a staggering the amount of times that this can disrupt your sleep, then that can also result in some changes, some biochemical changes within the brain that may also put you at risk of conditions like Alzheimer's disease.
How do you treat apnea then, sleep apnea?
So the gold standard treatment for people with severe sleep apnea is a treatment called CPAP or APAP. This is a mask that is applied to the face. A seal is made between the mask and the face, and the mask is connected to a small device that generates positive pressure. So essentially what you're doing is you're breathing against resistance, and that positive pressure keeps the airway open and stops it from collapsing down in sleep. There are a number of other treatments, but that is probably the most commonly used treatment.
Sounds very uncomfortable, Guy.
It is potentially uncomfortable, but what you have to remember is that a lot of people with severe sleep apnea feel dreadful during the day. They're excessively sleepy, they feel awful because their sleep is being disrupted several times an hour, and in many cases this mask can be life-changing. Okay. It can change somebody from being excessively sleepy, from dozing off at every possible opportunity, to really getting their life back. And a lot of people have a love-hate relationship with their CPAP. They hate the fact that they have to wear it every night, but they love the fact that they feel rejuvenated by it.
Will you talk about sleep problems in the menopause, please?
So I think that we know that there is a strong association between fluctuations in hormones in women and sleep quality. A lot of women complain of poor sleep in the few days before their periods, but those hormonal changes also that occur in the menopause can also give rise to hot flashes, which can disrupt the quality of sleep. And women often complain of very poor sleep as they go through the menopause. I think the key thing in that situation is obviously if your GP feels that HRT is appropriate, then that will sort the issue out. But the other thing to do is to concentrate on other aspects of your sleep to see if there's anything that you can do from a lifestyle perspective to try and improve the quality of your sleep. Simple things like avoiding too much caffeine, making sure you have regular sleep hours, making sure your environment is as comfortable as possible. One of the other issues that is often associated with hormonal fluctuations is a condition called restless leg syndrome, which is a neurological disorder that gives rise to a sensation of discomfort, usually in the legs, that's associated with an urge to move. And that can cause marked disruption of sleep, in particularly in women, although it affects men as well.
We won't get to all of the questions today, Guy, but we speak regularly to John Garvey, who you know, and he always reminds us about good sleep hygiene. And one of the things is about technology late at night. And you talk in your book about the Zeitgeber, is it Zeitgeber?
Yeah, Zeitgeber.
Tell people about that.
So we know that our circadian rhythm, our internal body clock, which sits in a part of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, is to some extent defined by our genes. So that some people, for example, are morning larks, some people are evening owls, and some people run on a standard 24-hour clock. But that internal body clock can also be influenced by external factors. It's not purely down to our genes. Psychological factors and, importantly, environmental factors like light, particularly blue light. There are direct connections between cells in the back of our eyes, in the retina, and the area of the brain that's responsible for regulating our internal body clock. And we know that if you expose yourself to blue light, particularly in the evenings, then what you're doing is you're messing with your internal body clock. You're pushing the internal body clock back, and actually you're affecting levels of a hormone called melatonin, which is an important signal from the brain to other parts of the brain, but also the rest of the body, that it's time to go to sleep. In fact, we know that if you expose yourself to bright light in the evenings, you can suppress your melatonin very, very well indeed. And so that can have important implications for your body clock, but it can also have important implications for the quality of your sleep.
Okay. Finally then, because I said I'd ask you about this, shift working. How detrimental is that to your health?
Well, I think it's detrimental in a number of ways. Essentially, if you are a shift worker, then you're trying to be awake and be asleep at times that your body clock is telling you otherwise. And so that has implications in terms of the quality of your sleep, but it can also result in people being chronically sleep deprived as well. And we know that that obviously has consequences in terms of how you feel during the day, but it can also have long-term health consequences. And in fact, the World Health Organization has recently added shift work to their list of possible carcinogens, things that might put you at risk of cancer. So the answer to that is probably that there is quite a significant negative impact of shift work on our general health.
Okay. So the nocturnal brain, Guy Leschner, Leschzinor, if you're looking for it in your shop or on Kindle or wherever. It's a really interesting read, and I really enjoyed our chat. Guy, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ray.
We're knocked 51551, ray@rte.ie. Now, it's hard to believe that it's 12 years this May since the disappearance of Madeleine McCann. She was abducted or kidnapped 9 days before her fourth birthday, which means that she would be 16 this May. A new documentary on Netflix entitled The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann is an 8-part documentary, and it's been getting a lot of attention and there's been a lot of discussion around it. Two people who feature extensively in the documentaries are journalist Anthony Summers and Robin Swan, and they're also co-authors of the book Looking for Madeleine, which is republished, and they join us now from the Cork studio. Good afternoon, Anthony and Robin.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Yeah. Hello.
Thanks so much for coming into our Cork studio. You live in Waterford.
We do. We live in West Waterford. Have lived there since a very long time, since the 70s.
Right. Why did you choose Waterford?
It chose me. Okay. There's a wonderful river there, the River Blackwater.
Yeah.
And it chose me. Before I wrote my first book, I had wanted to come to Ireland for what I thought might just be a year. And I rented a place at the mouth of the river and eventually rode upstream, and when the book succeeded, found myself a little ruin.
And God help me, I chose Anthony. So there we go.
And your children chose it by an accident of birth.
That's right.
So there you go. That's the family there. Okay, so the documentary, 8-hour-long documentaries on Netflix. What reaction have you got as a couple since, because you're in every episode, every documentary?
It's been fascinating. We've been sitting in the train going back and forth doing interviews and suddenly earwigging on young people behind us gossiping about the series and not realizing we were there. We've walked into elevators, heard people talking about it. In fact, I opened up a newspaper in this country a few days ago and saw that the Irish football team, the national team, and Mick McCarthy had them in the locker room. And what were the lads discussing? They were discussing the episodes of the McCann Netflix documentary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it seems to be everywhere.
Perhaps our most important reaction, though, has been, I should make it absolutely clear that we were interviewed, intensively interviewed for 2 days for the documentary, but we were not part of the project, part of the concept. And it was kept very secure while it was being made. We had the impression that the makers, the producers, were very responsible, even-handed, and I'm happy to say that they have justified that hope on our part. It's an even-handed, honest picture of this extraordinary story.
And Anthony, when you were writing the book, did you meet the McCanns?
Yes, I don't think we'd have kicked off the work if we had not done so. Remember that we got into it a long time after the story had started, after much hoo-ha and some very misleading headlines, particularly in the UK press, and also, of course, in the Portuguese press. And we kicked off the project by driving to see the McCanns, who had told us they would see us, through a snowstorm. Remember getting the ferry from Rosslare. Drove into a huge snowstorm and sat with them in the middle of winter. And most of the conversation was with Kate McCann, the little girl's, missing little girl's mother. And she listened and was helpful. And when her husband came home, you know, he's a cardiologist in Leicester in the UK, they made it clear that they were happy for us to do the book, but they wanted us to, first and foremost, to make contact with Scotland Yard. Their investigation was in full flood at that time, to make absolutely certain that nothing we did in our investigative work tripped wires, crossed with serious investigative leads that Scotland Yard were doing. So we hightailed it to London and saw the officer leading the investigation, Andy Redwood, and a senior colleague, and we motored very carefully all the way to the end with the knowledge, but not, don't get me wrong, they weren't giving us splendid leaks, but they were very careful and very honourable, and I hope we were too, and we made sure that we did not trip wires, so to speak, with them.
And Robin, did you interview the McCanns for the book, or did you just get their approval?
It was more a matter of a sort of hands-off. We wanted to work independently. We would have loved to have an extensive interview with them. In the end, they decided not to sit for something like that. So we relied on the best evidence we had, which were their many, many statements to the Portuguese police and Kate McCann's book, which has to be considered sort of their reflective, definitive telling of their side of events.
And this documentary then, the documentary makers approached the McCanns and they chose not to be involved in it.
That's true. And I suspect, and I don't know this, and I don't know anything more on this angle than you do, the McCanns have said they were concerned about the possibility of it hindering the investigation. I think that that was the same kind of thing they expressed to us when we approached them, that, you know, nothing happens that hinder the investigation. So that rings true to me. Sadly, there is also the fact that every time this story plays in the press, there are a brigade of armchair judges and juries who want to batter the McCanns anew with all sorts of conspiracy theories, and that's got to be a very tough position to be in, particularly for the parents of young children who are still at school and having to try to, as well as they can, get on with their lives.
Clarence Mitchell, who's the spokesperson for the McCanns, said on This Morning about the documentary, "This fuels those conspiracy theorists. There's whole websites and forums dedicated to vilifying Kate and Jerry and others around them, myself included. It's nonsense. If the allegations that have been disproven, discounted, are aired again, I'm afraid it will fuel that. Kate and Jerry ignore all of that."
Well, I hope they do, and let me intervene for a second to say that it's really not fair to the series. It is very, very balanced. They did the reporting, they showed the silly headlines that had emerged in the newspapers, which is part of all of our experience of the case, something that we've all seen, and they torpedoed some of the venomous slurs that have been spread about them, and they did so very effectively.
Is there any new information in the 8 hours of Netflix documentary?
I think there are some things that are, if not necessarily new, that certainly have never appeared on television before. There's an interview with the police dog handler whose work has been so much talked about. That's never been done before. There's a confrontational type exchange between a very highly regarded Portuguese journalist and the former Portuguese lead investigator about the leaks that were emerging from the Portuguese police force at the time. There's some very good interviewing with Jim Gamble, the former director of the Center for Missing and Exploited, the Center for Child Exploitation in the UK. Some really good perspectives that I think for the average person, a person who isn't steeped in every detail of this story, will really be new and revelatory.
Like you are. And the dogs come up over and over again. I would imagine in some of those conversations that you've eavesdropped on over the last few weeks, you would have heard that. So will you, just for people who don't know the ins and outs of it, would you just explain the whole dog thing to them?
I would hand that to Robin.
Right.
Well, late in the summer of 2007, when the Portuguese police were becoming frustrated with their lack of progress, they took the advice they had been given by the British and brought in a pair of British-trained dogs, one who was allegedly trained to pick up the scent of human cadaver, and the other who was trained to pick up the scent of decaying human blood. And these two dogs were dispersed at various points and alerted, gave their alert signals at a couple of occasions within the holiday flat the McCanns had occupied and to the car that the McCanns picked up and began renting about 3 or 4 weeks after Madeline disappeared, and a couple of other small items. This led to a forensic team going back to those locations and gathering what might be forensic evidence, and that was all sent off for DNA analysis. And people get very excited about the barking dogs. In the end, the DNA evidence that was gathered, the British Forensic Service concluded that it was not blood, that it was not Madeline's, and that it was of basically no relevance. And yet, those dog barks have been taken up and carried forward as alleged evidence of the McCann's involvement in something to do with Madeline's disappearance. I would add that a year later, the same dogs were deployed at a very infamous child abuse and alleged child murder scene in Jersey. And the dog that was trained to scent cadaver got terribly excited and alerted over something round and shaped like a child's skull, which later turned out to be a coconut shell.
Okay.
They're not infallible.
Yes.
What the handler has himself said, and he said it, fair dues, he said it in his initial, before he'd even done the examination of the McCann's apartment, he told the Portuguese police in very clear terms, in writing, that his discoveries or his dog's apparent discoveries were only an indication of a possible finding, that they were pointless, useless, meant nothing at all, unless they were confirmed then by further evidence. Mm. Now, there was no further evidence in this case. The DNA conclusion by the British Forensic Science Service was conclusive that there was no DNA identifiable with Madeleine McCann or indeed with any members of the family. And to sum it up, we interviewed Dr. Maureen Smythe, who had headed the Forensic Service here in the Republic. And she said, and this is a quote, the DNA, such as it is amounts to, quote, a whole lot of nothing.
Right. Just looking at the documentary, I was impressed by the amount of paperwork you two have been through to write your book. Like, it's boxes and boxes and boxes. So ye would be experts on the case.
Every book we do, right, we gather thousands of documents, and you may find this hard to believe, but the number of boxes that the Madeleine McCann case occupies is quite small. But yes,
compared to some of them,
yes, because you did the full story of 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, and you did a biography of Frank Sinatra and Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So this is small by comparison, but
it happened to be small by comparison. Yes, we did have access to the Portuguese police file. This was not a great coup. After the police in Portugal initially archived, which is put it on the shelf, they ended their investigation without making any charges, and by the way, exonerated any bad action, illegal actions on the part of the McCanns.
And you're emphatic in that, Anthony, that there is no evidence to suggest that Kate and Jerry McCann had anything to
absolutely
do with
not.
The disappearance of
we
their daughter.
We found not an iota during the 2+ years that we worked on it. No information that reflects badly on the McCanns at all. But what I was going to say is, in terms of the research we did with the papers, that when the case was archived by the Portuguese police, by law, the information on the case became most of it, except where it was particularly sensitive to people who might be in jail or on the way to jail or whatever, that most of the information, all the statements made by all the witnesses involved, were made public. That is to say, they were made public in Portuguese. An English translation had been made, which we then double-checked by, if we were using a piece of verbatim translation, we of course had it duly translated by your listeners will know that we're in Cork at the moment in the Cork studio of RTE, and we had the translations done by a scholar in Cork.
All right. You've had loads of chats among yourselves and with other people over the years, and what is the question that comes up over and over again between the two of ye and from other people?
Well, it's the question I'm sure you're going to get to. What do we think really happened?
Yeah.
And sadly, there is no evidence in this case. There is this extraordinary dearth of physical evidence. There's some pretty good witness testimony that is suggestive of a possible planned abduction. And I think if we had to come down to one thing, we'd probably suggest that seems the most likely to us. Now, to what end a planned abduction, an abduction in order to supply a child to a family who was desperate for one, an abduction for some darker purpose, that we have no notion of.
Yeah. Andy Redwood was put in place by Scotland Yard after David Cameron reopened the case in was it 2011? And yeah. He was an expert on cold cases. And since then, which I didn't hear much about at the time, there was the story of an intruder breaking into a number of holiday homes, villas, apartments in the lead up to Madeleine's disappearance. What do you know about that?
Well, only too much. In the sense that it eventually emerged from the British police investigations that there had been no less than 28 episodes, intrusions into homes or apartments rented or owned by British people within 40 miles of Praia da Luz. A typical event would be that a man would enter an apartment while the parents were either out or quite often sleeping in another room, but present. And they would go into a little girl's room. In the case I'm about to talk about, the room was, there was a very young little girl, I think 7 or 8, and an older sister, 10, 11. And in one particular case, the intruder came in and got not onto, at least, the bed with the little girl. And eventually was sort of scared off because her sister, she said, "Is that you, Daddy?" or words to that effect. And of course gathered that it wasn't Daddy. But this man, and it gives you chills.
Yes, it does.
This man had a mask over his face, a sort of like a medical mask, as best the kids could describe it, and sort of laundry or sheets or pillowcases or something like that wrapped around his feet, presumably to avoid leaving telltale footprints on the floor, but for whatever reason, and this had happened on 28, something like that had happened on 28 occasions, often with no actual sexual activity taking place, but sometimes with an actual sexual assault. And the man was never caught, mothers and fathers of those children eventually told Kate McCann that they had been at the time very dissatisfied with the way it had been investigated by the Portuguese police. Just the local constabulary had been involved, but the true investigative force, the Policia Judiciária, PJ, had never been called in, when of course they should have been.
Yeah.
Most shocking, perhaps, about that is that these cases, of course, were known to officialdom. They were known to people living in Portuguese people and residents of the Algarve. But people coming to, for example, the resort at which the McCann stayed, had not been told either about these sexual episodes or warned that there had been an epidemic of pilfering and robbing of apartments. And one wonders whether the McCanns would have, on the night that they and their fellow doctors sat across the swimming pool but away from their children, just making checks every 20 minutes or half an hour, whether they would ever have left their children there had they been given any kind of warning that this kind of crime had been taking place.
I think the answer is they wouldn't have, isn't it?
Of course it is.
Yeah, it's a fascinating 8-part documentary, and that scene that you described there, they do a reconstruction of it, and I was watching it last night, and it's very chilling. It's up there with horror movies, probably even more horrific because you know it's real. Thanks so much for coming into our Cork studio, Anthony and Robin, and your book, Looking for Madeleine. It's been reprinted.
It has.
We've updated it, and it's being reprinted. Yes.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
And that email address stays open overnight for any of your correspondence, ray@rte.ie. Frank says, "I didn't know what to think before watching the McCann documentary on Netflix, but after watching all episodes, I think they are 100% not guilty of any involvement in the disappearance of Maddie. The Portuguese police were a joke throughout the whole thing. Hope that she will be found someday," says Frank. You know, Frank, I think that 8 hours on Netflix, which is global, somebody watching may be, you know, a little memory maybe sparked from back in 2007, and they may come forward and they may have a crucial bit of evidence that will lead to maybe finding out what really happened to Madeleine McCann. That's it from us. Mary Wilson is on the way. We're back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.
The Ray Darcy Show. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.